saw patients, usually wealthy, upper-class ladies who arrived in sedan chairs like that. The doorman let him in without a word. Just as well. Geralt wasn't in the best of moods, and would certainly have retaliated with a word, or even two or three. The patio was deserted, and the water in the fountain burbled softly. There was a carafe and some cups on a small malachite table. Without further ado, Geralt poured himself a cup. When he raised his head, he saw Mirzaik in a white coat and apron, pale, with her hair slicked down. "It's you," she said. "You're back."
"It certainly is," he confirmed dryly. "I most certainly am. And this wine is most certainly a little sour."
"Such a pleasure seeing you again."
"Coral? Is she here? And if so, where?"
"I saw her between the thighs of a patient a moment ago," she shrugged. "She's most certainly still there."
"You indeed have no choice, Mirzaik," he responded calmly, looking her in the eyes. "You'll have to become a sorceress. In sooth, you have a great predisposition for it, and the makings of one. Your caustic wit wouldn't be appreciated in a weaving manufactory, nor yet in a bawdy house."
"I'm learning and growing." She withstood his gaze. "I don't cry myself to sleep any longer. I've done all my crying. I'm over that stage."
"No. No, you're not. You're deluding yourself. There's still a lot ahead of you. And sarcasm won't protect you from it, especially as it's forced at a pale imitation. But enough of that. It's not my job to give you lessons in life. I asked where Coral was."
"Here. Greetings."
The sorceress emerged from behind a curtain like a ghost. Like Mirzaik, she was wearing a white doctor's coat, and her red hair was pinned up and hidden by a linen cap, which in ordinary circumstances he would have thought ridiculous. But the circumstances weren't ordinary, and laughter would have been out of place. He needed a few seconds to understand that. She walked over and kissed him on the cheek without a word. Her lips were cold, and she had dark circles under her eyes. She smelled of medicine, and the fluid she used as disinfectant. It was a nasty, repulsive, morbid scent, a scent full of fear.
"I'll see you tomorrow," she forestalled him. "Tomorrow I'll tell you everything."
"Tomorrow."
She looked at him, and it was a faraway look from beyond the chasm of time and events between them. He needed a few seconds to understand how deep that chasm was, and how remote were the events separating them.
"Maybe the day after tomorrow would be better. Go to town. Meet that poet. He's been worried about you. But now go, please. I have to see a patient."
After she had gone, he glanced at Mirzaik, probably meaningfully enough for her not to delay with an explanation.
"We had a birth this morning," she said,
and her voice was a little different.
"A difficult one. She decided to use forceps, and everything that could have gone badly did."
"I understand."
"I doubt it."
"Goodbye, Mirzaik."
"You were away for a long time."
She raised her head.
"Much longer than she had expected. At Risberg, they didn't know anything, or at least pretended not to. Something happened, didn't it?"
"Yes, it did."
"I understand."
"I doubt it."
Dandelion impressed with his intelligence, by stating something so obvious that Geralt was still unable to completely adjust himself to it, or completely accept it.
"It's the end, isn't it? Gone with the wind? Of course, she and the sorcerers needed you. You've done the job, now you can go. And know what? I'm glad it's happening now. You had to finish that bizarre affair sometime, and the longer it went on, the more dangerous the consequences were potentially becoming. If you want to know my opinion, you should also be glad it's over, and that it went so smoothly. You should then dress your countenance in a joyful smile, not a saturnine and gloomy grimace, which, believe me, doesn't suit you at all. With it, you look quite simply like a man with a serious hangover, who, to cap it all, has got food poisoning and doesn't remember when he broke a tooth, and on what, or how he got the semen stains on his breeches. Or perhaps your melancholy results from something else," continued the bard, completely undaunted by the witch's lack of reaction. "If only from the fact that you were thrown out on your ear when you were planning a finale in your own inimitable style.
The one with the flight at dawn and flowers on the bedside table?
Being in love is like being at war, my friend, and your beloved behaved like an expert strategist. She acted preemptively, with a preventative strike. She must have read Marshall Pelligrum's The History of Warfare. Pelligrum cites many examples of victories won using a similar stratagem.
Geralt still didn't react. It was apparent that Dandelion didn't expect a reaction. He finished his beer and gestured to the innkeeper's wife to bring another.
Taking the above into consideration, he continued, twisting the pegs of his lute, I'm generally in favour of sex on the first date. In the future, I'd recommend it to you in every respect. It eliminates the necessity of any further rendezvous with the same person, which can be wearisome and time-consuming. While we're on the subject, the lady lawyer you recommended turned out indeed to be worth the bother. You wouldn't believe
I would, the witcher spat, interrupting him quite bluntly. I can believe it without hearing an account, so you can give it a miss.
Indeed, the bard noted. Dejected, distressed, and consumed by care, owing to which you're tetchy and brusque. It's not just the woman, it seems to me. There's something else. I know it, damn it, and see it. Did you fail in Novigrad? Didn't you get your swords back?
Geralt sighed, although he had promised himself he wouldn't.
No, I didn't. It was too late. There were complications and various things took place. We were caught by a storm, then our boat began to ship water, and then a certain glovemaker was taken seriously ill. I won't bore you with the details. In brief, I didn't make it in time. When I reached Novigrad, the auction was over. They gave me short shrift at the Borsodies. The auctions are shrouded in commercial confidentiality, protecting both the sellers and the buyers. The company doesn't issue any information to outsiders. Blah, blah, blah. Farewell, sir. I didn't find anything out. I don't know whether the swords were sold, and if so, who purchased them? I don't even know if the thief put the swords up for auction at all, for he might have ignored Pratt's advice. Another opportunity might have occurred. I don't know anything.
Too bad. Dandelion shook his head. It's a streak of unfortunate incidents. Cousin Ferron's investigation is at a standstill, it seems to me. Cousin Ferron, while we're on the subject, asks about you endlessly. Where you are, whether I have any tidings from you when you're returning, whether you'll make it to the royal nuptials in time, whether you've forgotten your promise to Prince Egmund. Naturally, I haven't said a word about your endeavours or the auction, but the holiday of Lunasa, I remind you, is getting closer. Only 10 days remain.
I know. But perhaps something will happen in the meantime. Something lucky, let's say. After the streak of unfortunate incidents, we could do with a change.
I don't deny it, but if I'll think it over and make a decision.
Geralt didn't let the bard finish.
Nothing in principle binds me to appear at the royal nuptials as his bodyguard. Egmund and the instigator didn't recover my swords, and that was the condition. But I absolutely don't rule out fulfilling the ducal wish. Material considerations, if nothing else, argue for it. The prince boasted he wouldn't skimp on a penny. And everything suggests that I'll be needing new swords, bespoke ones. And that will cost a great deal. What can I say? Let's go and eat, and drink.
To the Natura in Ravenna?
Not today. Today I feel like simple, natural, uncomplicated and honest things, if you know what I mean.
Of course I do, said Dandelion, standing up. Let's go down to the sea, to Palmyra. I know a place there. They serve herrings, vodka and soup made from a fish called the Big Head Carp. Don't laugh! That really is its name.
They can call themselves whatever they want. Let's go.
The bridge over the Adalat was blocked, for at that very moment a column of laden wagons and a troop of horsemen pulling riderless horses were passing over it. Geralt and Dandelion had to wait and step out of the way. A rider on a bay mare brought up the rear of the cavalcade. The mare tossed her head and greeted Geralt with a long, drawn-out neigh.
Roach!
Greetings, Witcher, said the horseman, removing his hood to reveal his face. I was just coming to visit you, although I hadn't expected we'd bump into each other so soon.
Greetings, Pinnity.
Pinnity dismounted. Geralt noticed he was armed. It was quite strange, since mages almost never bore arms. A sword in a richly decorated scabbard was hanging from the sorcerer's brass-studded belt. There was also a dagger, solid and broad. He took Roach's reins from the sorcerer and stroked the mare's nostrils and mane. Pinnity took off his gloves and stuck them into his belt.
"Please forgive me, Master Dandelion," he said, "but I'd like to be alone with Geralt. What I must say to him is meant for his ears only."
"Geralt has no secrets before me,"
Dandelion said, puffing himself up.
"I know. I learned many details of his private life from your ballads."
"But, Dandelion,"
the witch interrupted, "take a walk." "Thank you," he said when they were alone. "Thank you for bringing me my horse, Pinnity."
"I observed that you were attached to her," replied the sorcerer.
"So, when I found her in Pine Tops..."
"You were in Pine Tops?"
"We were. Constable Torquil summoned us."
"Did you see?"
"We did."
Pinnity cut him off curtly.
"We saw everything."
"I don't understand, Witcher."
"I don't understand.
Why didn't you hack him to death when you could, on the spot?"
"You didn't act too prudently, if I may say so."
"I know," thought Geralt to himself. "I know, how well I know. I turned out to be too stupid to take advantage of the chance fate had given me. For what harm would there have been in that? One more corpse in the statistics? What does that mean to a hired killer? So what if it sickened me to be your tool? I'm always somebody's tool, after all. I ought to have gritted my teeth and done what had to be done."
"This is sure to astonish you," said Pinnity, looking him in the eyes. "But we immediately came to help, Harlan and I. We guessed you were in need of assistance. We caught Degelan the following day when he was tearing apart some random gang."
"You caught him," the witcher thought to himself, "and broke his neck without thinking twice. Since you're cleverer than me, you didn't repeat my mistake." "Like hell you didn't. If it had been like that, you wouldn't be wearing a face like that now, Gwynkamp."
"We aren't murderers," stammered the sorcerer, blushing. "We hauled him off to Risberg and caused a mild commotion. Everybody was against us. Ortolan astonishingly behaved cautiously, and we'd actually expected the worst from him. But Viruta Ikati, pockmarked Axel, Sandoval, even Sanginis, who had previously been on our side. We had to listen to a lengthy lecture about the solidarity of the Fellowship, about fraternity, about loyalty. We learned that only utter good-for-nothings send hired killers after confrateurs, that you have to fall very low to hire a witcher to go after a comrade. For low reasons. Out of envy for our comrade's talent and prestige. Jealousy over his scientific achievements and successes.
Citing the incidents in the hills and the 44 corpses achieved nothing, the witcher thought to himself. Unless you count shrugs of the shoulders, and probably a lengthy lecture about science and the need to make sacrifices, and at the end justifying the means.
Dagoland, Pinnity continued, was hauled before the commission and dealt a severe reprimand for practising Goetia for the people killed by the demon. He was haughty, clearly counting on an intervention by Ortolan. But Ortolan had somehow forgotten about him, having devoted himself utterly to a fresh new passion, developing a formula for an extremely effective and universal manure meant to revolutionise agriculture. Left to fend for himself, Dagoland struck a different tone. Tearful and pathetic, he played the victim. A victim in equal measure of his own ambition and magical talent, into which he evoked a demon so powerful it was uncontrollable. He swore to abandon the practice of Goetia, that he would never touch it again, that he would utterly devote himself to research into perfecting the human species, into transhumanism, speciation, introgression, and genetic modification.
And they lent credence to him, the witcher thought to himself.
They lent credence to him. Ortolan, who suddenly appeared before the commission, stinking of manure, influenced them. He denominated Dagoland a dear youth, who had admittedly committed grievous miscalculations, but who is infallible. He didn't doubt that the youth would calibrate himself, and that he would vouch for it. He asked for the commission to temper its ire, to show compassion, and not excoriate the youth. He finally promulgated Dagoland his heir and successor, fully transferring his private laboratory in the Citadel to him. He himself, he declared, didn't need a laboratory, for he had resolved to toil and take exercise under the open sky, on vegetable patches and flower beds. This plan appealed to Biruta, pockmarked Axel, and the rest. The Citadel, bearing in mind its inaccessibility, could successfully be considered a place of correction. Dagoland had ensnared himself. He found himself under house arrest.
And the affair was swept under the carpet, the witcher thought to himself.
I suspect that consideration for you and your reputation had an influence on it, said Pinnity,
looking at him keenly. Geralt raised his eyebrows. "Your Witcher Code," continued the sorcerer, "reportedly forbids the killing of people. But it is said about you that you don't treat the code with due reverence, that this and that has occurred, that several people have departed this life thanks to you. Biruta and the others got cold feet, fearing that you'd return to Risberg and finish the job, and that they were in line for a beating too. But the Citadel is a fully secure refuge, a former gnomish mountain fortress converted into a laboratory and currently under magical protection. No one can get into the Citadel. There is no possibility. Dagoland is thus not only isolated, but also safe."
"Risberg is also safe," the Witcher thought to himself. "Safe from scandals and embarrassment. With Dagoland in isolation, there's no scandal. No one will ever know that the crafty bastard and careerist tricked and led up the garden path the sorcerers of Risberg, who believe themselves and declare themselves to be the elite of the magical fraternity. Or know that a degenerate psychopath took advantage of the naivety and stupidity of that elite and managed, without any hindrance, to kill almost 4 dozen people."
"Dagoland will be under supervision and observation in the Citadel," the sorcerer said, looking him in the eye the whole time. "He won't call forth any demon."
"There never was a demon, and you, Pinity, know that only too well."
"The Citadel," said the sorcerer, looking away and observing the ships at anchor, "is built into the rock of the Mount Cremora Massif, at the foot of which lies Risberg. An attempt to storm it would be tantamount to suicide, not only owing to the magical protection. Do you remember what you told us back then, about that possessed person whom you once killed? In case of absolute necessity, protecting one good at the cost of another, precluding the lawlessness of a forbidden deed in the process. Well, you must understand that the circumstances are now quite different. In isolation, Dagoland doesn't represent a genuine or direct threat. Were you to lay a finger on him, you would be committing a forbidden and lawless deed. Were you to try to kill him, you would go to court accused of attempted murder. Some of our people, I happen to know, hope you will nonetheless try, and end up on the scaffold. So I advise you, let it go. Forget about Dagoland. Leave it to run its course." "You say nothing," Pinity stated a fact. "You're keeping your comments to yourself."
"Because there's nothing to say. I'm only curious about one thing. You and Zara, will you remain at Risberg?"
Pinity laughed, dryly and hollowly.
"Both Harlan and I were asked to tender our resignation at our own request, by virtue of our state of health. We left Risberg, and we'll never return there. Harlan is going to Povis to serve King Rhyd, and I'm inclined to continue travelling. In the Empire of Nilfgaard, I hear, they treat mages functionally and without undue respect, but they pay them well. And while we're on the subject of Nilfgaard, I almost forgot. I have a farewell gift for you, Witcher." He undid his baldric, wrapped it around the scabbard, and handed the sword to Geralt. "It's for you," he said before the Witcher could speak. "I received it on my 16th birthday, from my father, who couldn't get over the fact that I'd decided to study magic. He hoped the gift would influence me, and that, as the owner of such a weapon, I would feel obliged to continue the family tradition and choose a military career. Why, I disappointed my father. In everything. I didn't like hunting, I preferred angling. I didn't marry the only daughter of his closest friend. I didn't become a military man, and the sword gathered dust in a cupboard. I have no need of it. It will serve you better.
But, Pinity,
take it. Don't make a fuss. I know your swords went missing, and you're in need."
Geralt grasped the lizard-skin hilt and drew the blade halfway out of the scabbard. 1 inch above the crossguard, he saw a punch in the shape of the sun in its glory, with 16 rays alternating straight and wavy, symbolizing heraldically the light and heat of the sun. A beautifully executed inscription in stylized lettering, a famous trademark, began 2 inches beyond the sun.
"A blade from Virilada,"
the Witcher stated a fact, this time authentic.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Nothing, nothing. I'm admiring it, and I still don't know if I can accept it."
"You can. In principle, you already have received it, since you're holding it.
Elspeth, don't make a fuss, I said. I'm giving you the sword because I like you, so that you'll realize not every sorcerer has it in for you. Anyway, the fishing rods are more use to me. The rivers are beautiful and crystal clear in Nilfgaard. There's plenty of trout and salmon in them.
Thank you.
Pinity.
Yes?
Are you giving me the sword purely because of liking me?
Why, because I like you indeed.
The sorcerer lowered his voice.
But perhaps not only.
What does it bother me what happens here, and what purposes the sword will serve? I'm leaving these parts, never to return.
You see that splendid galleon lying at anchor?
It's Yoreari. Its home port is Bacala. I sail the day after tomorrow.
You arrived a little early.
Yes, said the mage, stammering slightly. I wanted to say goodbye to someone.
Good luck. Thanks for the sword. And for the horse. Thanks again. Farewell, Pinity.
Farewell. The sorcerer shook Geralt's extended hand without thinking. Farewell, Witcher. He found Dandelion,
where else,
in the portside tavern, slurping fish soup from a bowl.
I'm leaving, he announced briefly. Right away.
Right away?
Dandelion froze with the spoon halfway to his mouth.
Right now? I thought...
It doesn't matter what you thought. I ride immediately. Reassure your cousin, the instigator. I'll be back for the royal nuptials.
What's that?
What does it look like?
A sword, naturally.
Where did you get it?
From the sorcerer, was it? And the one I gave you? Where's that?
It got lost. Return to the upper town, Dandelion.
What about Coral?
What about Coral?
What do I say if she asks?
She won't. She won't have time. She'll be saying farewell to somebody.
Interlude. Confidential. Illustrissimus et Reverendissimus Magnus Magister Narcisse de la Roche, the head of the chapter of the Gift and the Art, Novigrad. Datum, ex Castello Risberg, DA 15 Mens, Jewel Anno, 1245, post Resurrectionem. Re, Master of the Arts, Sorrel Albert Amador Degelund. Honoratissime Grandmaster. Rumours about the incidents which occurred on the western borders of Temeria in the summer of Anno Corrente have doubtless reached the ears of the chapter. The result of the said incidents, presumably, is that around 40, it is impossible to state precisely, persons, mainly unschooled forestry labourers, lost their lives. These incidents are associated, regrettably, with the person of Master Sorrel Albert Amador Degelund, a member of the research team at the Risberg Complex. The research team of the Risberg Complex is united in sympathy with the families of the victims of the incidents, although the victims, who stand very low in the social hierarchy, abusing alcohol and leading immoral lives, were probably not in legalized unions. We wish to remind the chapter that Master Degelund, a pupil and acolyte of Grandmaster Ortolan, is an outstanding scientist, a specialist in the field of genetics, boasting immense, simply incalculable accomplishments in transhumanism, introgression, and speciation. The research that Master Degelund is conducting may turn out to be pivotal for the development and evolution of the human race. As is known, the human race is no match for the non-human races in terms of many physical, psychological, and psychomagical traits. Master Degelund's experiments, based on the hybridization and combination of the gene pool, are intended, in the beginning, to equalize the human race with non-human races, while, in the long term, by the application of speciation, to permit humans to dominate non-humans and subdue them utterly. It is probably unnecessary to explain what cardinal significance this matter has. It would be inadvisable for some trifling incidents to impede or stop the above-mentioned scientific studies. As far as Master Degelund himself is concerned, the research team of the Risberg Complex takes full responsibility for his medical care. Master Degelund was previously diagnosed with narcissistic tendencies, absence of empathy, and slight emotional disturbances. During the time preceding the perpetration of the acts he is accused of, the condition intensified until symptoms of bipolar disorder occurred. It may be stated that, at the time the acts he is accused of were committed, Master Dagoland was not in control of his emotional reactions, and his ability to differentiate between good and evil was impaired. It may be assumed that Dagoland was non compos mentis, eo ipso, was temporarily insane. Hence, he cannot take criminal responsibility for the acts ascribed to him, since impune est admittendum quod per furorum aliquius accidit. Master Dagoland has been placed ad interim in a secret locality where he is being treated and is continuing his research. Since we consider the matter closed, we wish to draw the chapter's attention to Constable Torquil, who is conducting the investigation into the matter of the Temerian incidents. Constable Torquil, a subordinate of the bailiff in Gaulsverlaine, otherwise known as a diligent functionary and staunch defender of law, is exhibiting excessive zeal as regards the incidents in the above-mentioned settlements, and is following, from our point of view, a decidedly inappropriate trail. His superiors ought to be persuaded to temper his enthusiasm. And were that not to be effective, it would be worth investigating the personal files of the constable, his wife, parents, grandparents, children, and other members of his family, paying special attention to his private life, past, criminal record, material affairs, and sexual preferences. We suggest contacting the law firm of Codringer and Fenn, whose services, if I may remind the chapter, were taken advantage of 3 years ago with the aim of discrediting and ridiculing the witnesses in the case known as the Corn Affair. Item. We would like to draw the chapter's attention to the fact that, unfortunately, the witcher, called Geralt of Rivia, has become embroiled in the matter in question. He had direct access to the incidents in the settlements, and we also have reason to suppose that he connects those events with Master Dagoland. The said witcher ought also to be silenced, should he begin to delve too deeply into the matter. We would like to point out that the asocial attitude, nihilism, emotional instability and chaotic personality of the aforementioned witcher may mean that a stark warning may prove to be non sufficit, and extreme measures will turn out to be necessary. The witcher is under permanent surveillance, and we are prepared to apply such measures if, naturally, the chapter approves and orders it. In hopes that the above explanation will turn out to be sufficient for the chapter to close the matter, bene valere optimus, and we remain yours sincerely. On behalf of the Risberg Complex Research Team, Semper Fidelis Vestrarum Bona Amica, Viruta Animarchet Icarte, Mano Propria. Chapter 17.
Just in time, said Franz Torquil morosely. You made it on time, Witcher. Right on time. The spectacle's about to begin.
He lay on his back on a bed, as pale as a whitewashed wall, his hair wet with sweat and plastered to his forehead. He was wearing nothing but a coarse linen shirt that had once reminded Geralt of a winding sheet. His left thigh was swathed down to the knee in a blood-soaked bandage. A table had been put in the centre of the room and covered in a sheet. A squat individual, in a black jerkin, was setting out tools on the table, one after the other in turn. Knives, forceps, chisels, saws.
I regret but one thing, said Torquil, grinding his teeth, that I didn't catch the Horsens. It was the gods' will. It wasn't written for me. And now it won't come to pass. What happened? A sodding same as in Utrecht, Rogovitzner and Pintoffs. Except it wasn't like the others, but at the very edge of the forest. And not in a clearing, but on the highway. They'd surprised some travellers. They'd killed three and abducted two bairns. As luck would have it, I was nearby with my men. We gave chase at once, soon heard them in sight. Two great bruises as big as oxen, and one misshapen hunchback. And that hunchback shot me with a crossbow.
The constable gritted his teeth and waved a hand at his bandaged thigh.
I ordered my men to leave me and follow them. They disobeyed, the curs, and as a result they made off. And me? So what if they saved me when they're cutting my leg off now? I'd rather have fucking pegged it there, but seen them uns kicking their legs on the scaffold before my eyes clouded over. The wretches didn't obey my orders. Now they're sitting there, hangdog.
To a man, the constable's subordinates were indeed sitting shamefacedly on a bench by the wall. They were accompanied by a wrinkled old woman with a garland on her head that didn't match her grey hair at all, who looked completely out of place.
"We can begin," said the man in the black jerkin. "Put the patient on the table and strap him down tightly. All outsiders to leave the chamber."
"They can stay," growled Torquil. "I want to know they're watching. I'll be too ashamed to scream."
"One moment," Geralt said, straightening up. "Who decided that amputation is inevitable?"
"I did," said the man in black,
also drawing himself up to his full height, but having to lift his head up high to look Geralt in the face.
"I'm Messer Lupi, physician to the bailiff in Gorsvalaine, specially sent for. An examination has confirmed that the wound is infected. The leg has to go. There's no hope for it."
"How much do you charge for this procedure?"
20 crowns.
"Here's 30, said Geralt,
digging 3 10-crown coins from a pouch.
"Take your instruments, pack up and return to the bailiff.
Should he ask, say the patient is improving."
"But I must protest."
"Get packed and return."
"Which of those words don't you understand?
And you, Nana, to me. Unwind the bandage."
"They forbade me from touching the patient,"
she said, nodding at the court physician.
"Says I'm a quack and a witch. Threatened to inform on me."
"Ignore him. Indeed, he's just leaving."
The old woman, whom Geralt at once recognized as a herbalist, did as she was told. She unwound the bandage with great care, but it was enough to make Torquil shake his head, hiss and groan.
"Geralt!" he groaned. "What are you playing at? The physician said there's no hope. Better to lose a leg than my life." "Bullshit. It's not better at all, and I'll shut up."
The wound looked hideous, but Geralt had seen worse. He took a box from the pouch containing elixirs. Messer Lupi, now packed, looked on, shaking his head.
"Those decocts are fit for nothing," he announced. "Those quack tricks and that bogus magic is fit for nothing. It's nothing but charlatanism. As a physician, I must protest."
Geralt turned around and stared. The physician exited, in a hurry, tripping over the doorstop.
4 men to me," said the Witcher,
uncorking a vial.
"Hold him fast. Clench your teeth, friends."
The elixir foamed copiously as it was poured over the wound. The constable groaned heartrendingly. Geralt waited a while and then poured on another elixir. That one also foamed and hissed and smoked as well. Torquil screamed, tossed his head around, tensed up, rolled his eyes, and fainted. The old woman took a canteen from her bundle, scooped out a handful of green ointment, smeared it thickly on a piece of folded linen, and applied it to the wound.
"Nitbone," guessed Geralt. "A poultice of nitbone, arnica and marigold." "Good, Nana. Very good. Goatweed and oak bark would also come in use."
"Hark it in,"
interrupted the old woman, without raising her head from the constable's leg.
"Trying to teach me herbalism. I was healing people with herbs when you were still puking your porridge over your wet nurse, laddie. And you lummoxes, away with you, for you're blocking out the light. And you stink dreadfully. You ought to change your foot wraps from time to time. Out with you, hear me?"
"His leg will have to be immobilised, set in long splints."
"Don't instruct me," I said. "And get you gone as well. Why are you still here? What are you waiting for? For thanks that you nobly gave up your magical witcher medicaments? For a promise that you won't forget it till his dying day?"
"I want to ask him something." "Promise me, Geralt, that you'll catch them," said Franz Torquil,
suddenly quite lucid.
"That you won't let them off."
"I'll give him a sleeping draught and something for the fever, because he's raving. And you, witcher, get out. Wait in the yard."
He didn't have to wait long. The old woman came out, hitched up her dress, and straightened her crooked garland. She sat beside him on the step, and rubbed one foot against the other. She had extremely small feet.
"He's sleeping," she announced. "And will probably live, if nothing evil sets in, touch wood. The bone will knit. You've saved his pin with them witcher charms. He'll always be lame, and he'll never mount a horse again, I dare say. But 2 legs are better than one."
She reached into her bosom beneath her embroidered sheepskin vest, making the air smell even more strongly of herbs. She drew out a wooden casket and opened it. After a moment's hesitation, she proffered it to Geralt.
"Want a snort?"
"No, thank you. I don't use fishneck."
"But I,"
said the herbalist, sniffing up the drug, first into one, then the other nostril.
"But I do, from time to time. sharpens up the mind like no one's bloody business. Increases longevity and improves the looks. Just look at me.
He did.
Thanking you for the witcher medicaments for Franz, she said,
wiping a watering eye and sniffing.
I won't forget it. I know you jealously guard those decocts of yours, and you gave them to me without a second thought, even though you may run short when you're next in need. Aren't you afraid?
I am.
She turned her head to show her profile. She must indeed have been a beautiful woman once, a long time ago.
And now?
She turned to face him.
Speak. You meant to ask Franz something.
Never mind. He's sleeping and it's time I was off.
Speak.
Mount Cremora.
You should have said. What do you want to know about that mountain?
The cottage stood quite far outside the village, hard by the wall of the forest, which began just beyond a fence surrounding an orchard full of small trees laden with apples. The rest had all the hallmarks of a typical homestead. A barn, a shed, a henhouse, several beehives, a vegetable patch, and a muck heap. A thin trail of white, pleasant-smelling smoke was wafting from the chimney. The guinea fowl, scurrying around by the wattle fencing, noticed him first, raising the alarm with a hellish screeching. Some children, playing in the farmyard, dashed towards the cottage. A woman appeared in the doorway. Tall, fair-haired, and wearing an apron over a coarse linen frock. He rode closer and dismounted.
"Greetings," he said. "Is the man of the house at home?"
The children, all of them little girls, clung to their mother's skirts and apron. The woman looked at the witcher, and any search for friendliness in those eyes would have been in vain. No wonder. She caught a good sight of the sword hilt over his shoulder, of the medallion on his neck, and of the silver studs on his gloves, which the witcher was by no means hiding. Rather, he was flaunting them.
"The man of the house," he repeated. "I mean Otto Dussart. I want to talk to him about something."
"What?"
"It's private. Is he at home?"
She stared at him in silence, slightly tilting her head. She had rustic looks, and he guessed she might be aged anything between 25 and 45. A more precise assessment, as with the majority of village women, was impossible.
"Is he at home?"
"No."
"Then I'll wait until he returns," he said, tossing the mare's reins over a pole.
"You might have to wait a while."
"I'll hold out somehow. Although, in truth, I'd prefer to wait inside than by the fence."
The woman eyed him up and down for a moment. Him and his medallion.
"Accept our invitation, guest," she said finally. "Step inside."
"Gladly," he answered, using the customary formula. "I won't transgress the rules of hospitality."
"You won't,"
she repeated, in a slow drawling voice.
"Yet you were a sword."
"Such is my profession."
"Swords injure and kill."
"So does life. Does the invitation still apply?"
"Please enter."
One entered, typically for such homesteads, through a gloomy, cluttered passage. The main chamber turned out to be quite spacious, light and clean, with only the walls near the range and chimney bearing sooty streaks. Otherwise, the walls were painted freshly white and decorated with gaily embroidered wall hangings. Various household utensils, bunches of herbs, plats of garlic and strings of capsicums enlivened the walls. A woven curtain separated the chamber from the larder. It smelt of cooking. Cabbage, to be precise.
"Please be seated."
The housewife remained standing, crumpling her apron in her hands. The children crouched by the stove on a low bench. The medallion on Geralt's neck was vibrating, powerfully and constantly. It fluttered under his shirt like a captured bird.
"You ought to have left the sword in the passage,"
the woman said, walking over to the range.
"It's indecent to sit down to table with a weapon. Only brigands do so. Be you a brigand?"
"You know who I am."
He cut her off.
"And the sword stays where it is, to act as a reminder."
"Of what?"
"That hasty actions have perilous consequences."
There's no weapons here, so yes, yes, he interrupted bluntly. Let's not kid ourselves, missus. A peasant's cottage and farmyard is an arsenal. Many have died from hoes, not to mention flails and pitchforks. I heard that someone was killed with a plunger from a butter churn. You can do harm with anything if you want to, or have to. And while we're on the subject, leave that pot of boiling water alone and move away from the stove.
I meant nothing, the woman said quickly, evidently lying. And it's not boiling water, it's borscht. I meant to offer you some.
No, thank you. I'm not hungry. So don't touch the pot and move away from the stove. Sit down by the children, and we'll wait nicely for the man of the house.
They sat in a silence, broken only by the buzzing of flies. The medallion twitched.
A pan of cabbage in the oven is almost ready, said the woman,
interrupting the awkward silence.
I must take it out and stir it, or it'll burn.
Her.
Geralt pointed to the smallest of the girls.
She can do it.
The girl stood up slowly, glaring at him from under a flaxen fringe. She took hold of a long-handled fork and bent over towards the stove door, and suddenly launched herself at Geralt like a she-cat. She aimed to pin him by his neck to the wall with the fork, but he dodged, jerked the fork handle, and knocked her over. She began to metamorphosize before even hitting the floor. The woman and the other two girls had already managed to transform. Three wolves, a grey she-wolf and two cubs, bounded towards the Witcher, with bloodshot eyes and bared fangs. They bounded apart, quite like wolves, attacking from all sides. He dodged, shoved the bench at the she-wolf, fending the cubs away with blows of his fists in his silver-studded gloves. They howled and flattened themselves against the floor, baring their fangs. The she-wolf howled savagely and leapt again. No, Edwina, no! She fell on him, pressing him to the wall, but now in human form. The wolf girls immediately fled and hunkered down by the stove. The woman remained, crouching before him, staring with embarrassed eyes. He didn't know if she was ashamed because of attacking him, or because the attack had failed.
Edwina, what is the meaning of this?
Bellowed a bearded man of impressive height, arms akimbo.
What are you doing?
It's a witcher,
the woman snorted, still on her knees.
A brigand with a sword. He came for you, the murderer. He reeks of blood.
Silence, woman. I know him. Forgive her, Master Geralt. Everything in order? Forgive her. She didn't know. She thought that since you're a witcher...
He broke off and looked nervously. The woman and the little girls were gathered by the stove. Geralt could have sworn he heard a soft growling.
It's all right, he said. I bear no ill will. But you showed up just in time, not a moment too soon. I know, said the bearded man,
shuddering perceptibly.
Sit you down, sir. Sit down at table. Edwina, bring beer. No. Outside, Dusart, for a word.
In the middle of the farmyard sat a grey cat that fled in a trice at the sight of the Witcher and hid in the nettles.
I don't wish to upset your wife or frighten your children, Geralt announced. And what's more, I have a matter I'd prefer to talk about in private. It concerns a certain favour. Whatever you want, sir, said the bearded man. Just say it. I'll fulfil your every wish if it's in my power. I'm indebted to you, greatly indebted. Thanks to you, I walk alive through this world, because you spared me then. I owe you, not me, yourself, because even in lupine form, you remained a man and never harmed anybody. I never harmed anybody, 'tis true. And how did I benefit? My neighbours, having become suspicious, brought a witcher down on me at once. Though paupers, they scrimped and saved in order to hire you. I thought about giving them back their money, admitted Geralt, but it might have aroused suspicion. I gave them my witcher word that I'd removed the werewolf spell from you and had completely healed you of lycanthropy, that you are now as normal as the next man. Such a feat has to cost. If people pay for something, they believe in it. Whatever it's paid for becomes real and legal. The more expensive, the better. Recalling that day sends shivers down my spine, said Dusart, paling under his tan. I almost died of fear when I saw you with that silver blade. I thought my last hour had come. There's no end of stories about witcher murderers relishing blood and torture.
You, it turned out, are a decent fellow, and a good one. Let's not exaggerate. But you followed my advice and moved out of Guames.
I had to,
Desart said gloomily.
The people of Guames believed in theory that I was free of the spell. But you were right. A former werewolf doesn't have it easy either. It was as you said. What you used to be means more to people than what you are. I was compelled to move out and roam through strange surroundings where no one knew me. I wandered and wandered until I finally ended up here and met Edwina.
It really happens for two Therianthropes to form a couple, said Geralt, shaking his head. It's even more seldom for children to be born to such couples. You're a lucky man, Dusart.
If only you knew, grinned the werewolf. My children are as pretty as a picture. They're grown up into beautiful maidens. And Edwina and I were made for each other. I wish to be with her to the end of my days.
She knew me as a witcher at once, and was prepared to defend herself. She meant to throw boiling borscht over me, would you believe? She must also have heard her fill of werewolf tales about bloodthirsty witches relishing torture.
Forgive her, Master Geralt. And we shall soon savour that borscht. Edwina makes delicious borscht.
It might be better if I don't impose, said the witcher, shaking his head. I don't want to scare the children, much less worry your wife. To her, I'm still a brigand with a sword. It'd be hard to expect her to take to me at once. She said I reek of blood. Metaphorically, I understand.
Not really. No offence, Master Witcher, but you stink to high heaven of it.
I haven't had any contact with blood for about 2 weeks, I'd say.
The werewolf finished his sentence.
It's clotted blood. Dead blood. You touched someone who was bleeding. There's also earlier blood, over a month old. Cold blood. Reptile blood. You've also bled. Living blood from a wound.
I'm full of admiration.
Us werewolves, said Dusart, standing up proudly. Have a slightly more sensitive sense of smell than you humans.
I know, smiled Geralt. I know that the werewolf's sense of smell is a veritable wonder of nature, which is why I've come to ask you for a favour.
Shrews, said Dusart, sniffing. Shrews, and voles, lots of voles, dung, lots of dung, mainly marten, and weasel. Nothing else.
The witcher sighed and then spat. He didn't conceal his disappointment. It was the fourth cave where Dusart hadn't smelled anything apart from rodents and the predators that hunted them, and an abundance of both the former and latter's dung. They moved on to the next opening, gaping in the rock wall. Pebbles shifted under their feet and rolled down the scree. It was steep. They proceeded with difficulty, and Geralt was beginning to feel weary. Dusart either turned into a wolf or remained in human form, depending on the terrain.
A she-bear, he said,
looking into the next cave and sniffing.
With young. She was there, but she's not any more. There are marmots, shrews, bats, lots of bats, stoat, marten, wolverine, lots of dung.
The next cavern.
A female polecat. She's on heat. There's also a wolverine. No, two. A pair of wolverines. An underground spring. The water's slightly sulphurous. Gremlins. A whole flock. Probably 10 of them. Some sort of amphibians. Probably salamanders. Bats.
An immense eagle flew down from a rocky ledge located somewhere overhead and circled above, crying out repeatedly. The werewolf raised his head and glanced at the mountain peaks and the dark clouds gliding out from behind them.
Is a storm coming? What a summer, when there's almost not a day without a storm. What should we do, Master Geralt? Another hole?
Another hole.
In order to reach the next one, they had to pass under a waterfall cascading down from a cliff. Not very large, but sufficient to wet them through. The moss-covered rocks were as slippery as soap. Dusart metamorphosed into a wolf to continue. Geralt, after slipping dangerously several times, forced himself onward, cursed, and overcame a difficult section on all fours.
Lucky Dandelion's not here, he thought. He'd have turned it into a ballad.
The lycanthrope in front in wolfish form, with the witcher behind him on all fours.
people would have had a ball. A large hole, Master Witcher, said Dusart, sniffing. Broad and deep. There are mountain trolls there. 5 or 6 hefty trolls. And bats. Loads of bat dung. We'll go on to the next one. Trolls. Same trolls as before. The caves are connected. A bear? A cub? It was there, but it's gone. Not long since. Marmots? Bats? Vampiroids?
The werewolf leapt back from the next cave as though he'd been stung.
A gorgon, he whispered. There's a huge gorgon deep in the cave. It's sleeping. There's nothing else apart from it. I'm not surprised, the witcher muttered. Let's go our way, silently, because it's liable to awaken.
They walked away, looking back anxiously. They approached the next cave, fortunately located away from the Gorgon's lair, slowly, aware that it wouldn't do any harm to be cautious. It didn't do any harm, but turned out to be unnecessary. The next few caves didn't hide anything in their depths other than bats, marmots, mice, voles and shrews, and thick layers of dung. Geralt was weary and resigned. Dusart clearly was too. But he kept his chin up, you had to grant him that, and didn't betray any discouragement by word or gesture. But the Witcher didn't have any illusions. The werewolf had his doubts about the operation's chances of success. In keeping with what Geralt had once heard and what the old herbalist had confirmed, the steep eastern cliff of Mount Cremora was riddled with holes, penetrated by countless caves. And indeed, they found countless caves. But Dusart clearly didn't believe it was possible to sniff out and find the right one, which was an underground passage leading inside the rocky complex of the citadel. To make matters worse, there was a flash of lightning and a clap of thunder. It began to rain. Geralt had a good mind to spit, swear coarsely, and declare the enterprise over. But he overcame the feeling.
Let's go on, Dusart. Next hole.
As you wish, Master Geralt.
And suddenly, quite like in a cheap novel, a turning point in the action occurred by the next opening gaping in the rock.
Bats, announced the werewolf, sniffing. Bats and a cat.
A lynx. A wild cat.
A cat, said Dusart, standing up. An ordinary domestic cat.
Otto Dusart looked at the small bottles of elixirs with curiosity and watched the Witcher drinking them. He observed the changes taking place in Geralt's appearance, and his eyes widened in wonder and fear.
"Don't make me enter that cave with you," he said. "No offence, but I'm not going. The fear of what might be there makes my hair stand on end." "It never occurred to me to ask you to. Go home, Dusart, to your wife and children. You have done me a favour. You've done what I asked of you, so I can't demand any more."
"I'll wait," protested the werewolf. "I'll wait until you emerge."
"I don't know when I'll be coming out," said Geralt,
adjusting the sword on his back.
"Or if I'll come out at all."
"Don't say that. I'll wait. I'll wait until dusk."
The cave bottom was carpeted in a dense coat of bat guano. The bats themselves, pot-bellied flittermice, were hanging in whole clusters on the cave ceiling, wriggling and squeaking drowsily. At first, the ceiling was high above Geralt's head, and he could walk along the level bottom tolerably quickly and comfortably. The comfort soon ended, however. First he had to stoop, then stoop lower and lower, and finally, nothing remained but to move along on his hands and knees, and ultimately, crawl. There was a moment when he stopped, determined to turn back, when the cramped conditions represented a grave risk of getting stuck. But he could hear the whoosh of water and feel on his face a current of cold air. Aware of the risk, he forced his way through a crack and sighed in relief as it began to open out. All of a sudden, the corridor turned into a chute down which he slid straight into the channel of an underground stream, gushing out from under a rock and disappearing under another. Somewhere above was a weak light, emanating from the same place as cold gusts of air. The pool the stream vanished into appeared to be totally underwater, and the Witcher wasn't keen on the idea of swimming through, although he suspected it was a sump. He chose a route upstream against the fast-flowing current along a ramp leading upwards. Before emerging from the ramp into a great chamber, he was completely drenched and covered in silt from the lime deposits. The chamber was huge, covered all over with majestic dripstones, draperies, stalagmites, stalactites, and stalagmates. The stream flowed along the bottom in a deeply hollowed-out meander. There was also a gentle glow of light and a weak draught. There was a faint odour. The witch's sense of smell couldn't compete with the werewolf's, but he also smelled what the werewolf had earlier, the faint odour of cat urine. He stopped for a moment and looked around. The draught pointed to the exit, an opening like a palace portal flanked by pillars of mighty stalagmites. Right alongside, he saw a hollow full of fine sand. That hollow was what smelt of cat. He saw numerous feline paw prints in the sand. He slung his sword, which he'd had to remove in the cramped space of the fissure, across his back, and passed between the stalagmites. The corridor, leading gently upwards, had a high ceiling and was dry. There were large rocks on the bottom, but it was possible to walk. He set off, until his way was blocked by a door, robust and typical of a castle. Until that moment, he hadn't been at all certain if he was following the right track, had no certainty that he had entered the right cave. The door seemed to confirm his choice. There was a small opening in the door, just above the threshold, which had quite recently been carved out. A passage for the cat. He pushed the door. It didn't budge, but the witch's amulet quivered slightly. The door was magical, protected by a spell. The weak vibration of the medallion suggested, however, that it wasn't a powerful spell. He brought his face close to the door. Friend. The door opened noiselessly on oiled hinges. As he had accurately guessed, it had been equipped with a standard weak magical protection and a basic password, as no one, fortunately for him, had felt like installing anything more sophisticated. It was intended to separate the castle from the cave complex and deter any creatures incapable of using even simple magic. The natural cave ceased beyond the door, which he wedged open with a stone. A corridor carved out of the rock with pickaxes extended before him. In spite of all the evidence, he still wasn't certain, until the moment he saw light in front of him, the flickering light of a brand or a cresset, and a moment later heard some very familiar laughter, cackling. The light and cackling, it turned out, were coming from a large room illuminated by a torch stuck into an iron basket. Trunks, boxes and barrels were piled up against the walls. Boo and Bang were sitting at one of the crates using barrels as seats. They were playing dice. Bang was cackling, clearly having thrown a higher number. There was a demijohn of moonshine on the crate, and beside it some kind of snack. A roast human leg. The Witcher drew his sword. Hello, boys. Boo and Bang stared at him open-mouthed for some time. Then they roared and leapt to their feet, knocking over the barrels and snatching up their weapons. Boo a scythe and Bang a broad scimitar, and charged the Witcher. They took him by surprise, although he hadn't expected it to be an easy fight, but he hadn't expected the misshapen giants to move so fast. Boo swung his scythe low, and had it not been for a jump, Geralt would have lost both legs. He barely dodged Bang's blow, the scimitar striking sparks from the rock wall. The Witcher was able to cope with fast opponents, and large ones too. Fast or slow, large or small, they all had places sensitive to pain. And they had no idea how fast a Witcher could be after drinking his elixirs. Boo howled, lacerated on the elbow, and Bang, cut on the knee, howled even louder. The Witcher deceived Boo with a swift spin, jumped over the scythe blade, and cut him in the ear with the very tip of his blade. Boo roared, shaking his head, swung the scythe and attacked. Geralt arranged his fingers and struck him with the Ard sign. Assaulted by the spell, Boo flopped onto his backside on the floor and his teeth rang audibly. Bang took a great swing with a scimitar. Geralt nimbly ducked under the blade, slashing the giant's other knee in passing, spun around and leapt at Boo, who was struggling to stand up, cutting him across the eyes. Boo managed to pull his head back, however, and was caught on the brow ridge. Blood instantly blinded the ogre troll. Boo yelled and leapt up, attacking Geralt blindly. Geralt dodged away. Boo lurched towards Bang and collided with him. Bang shoved him away.